This is Scott Becker with the Becker Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by an emergency room physician and ER doctor working in New York City, Dr. Malik Trivedi. And we're going to talk to Dr. Trivedi about both COVID-19 and sort of what he's seeing there, as well as a couple other questions on a broader general landscape. And Dr. Trivedi, let me ask you to start by introducing yourself, and then we'll get started.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Scott. So Malik Trivedi is my name. I'm an emergency medicine physician. Scott mentioned I live in the New York area. I actually live in Midtown, New York, and I've been practicing for 20-some years, and unfortunately have become a kind of a COVID specialist. We are seeing the impact of it in our area especially. Fortunately, it is abating a little bit, it's definitely given us a unique perspective on emergency medicine, healthcare in general, and what's to come appears like in other areas of the country. So,
and tell us a little bit about what you've learned and what you've seen.
Well, you know, I have to say it's been on our radar for quite some time. Ironically, in retrospect, I can tell you that I'd say maybe early January, maybe late. Mid to late January, where we had patients that came in, and I distinctly remember one patient that wasn't quite sure what was going on, a picture of asthma, respiratory symptoms, and wasn't getting any better. And we did some studies, which now in retrospect, I'm like, my gosh, well, you know, that was COVID. If that patient would come in, you know, yesterday or today, I'd be like, right away, that's COVID without even thinking twice. So it's been around. But I can tell you that being on, let's just say the front lines of this, we've seen this slow kind of movement of policy kind of lagging behind what's happening, boots on the ground. So we've been kind of prepared as a group. I'd say as emergency medicine physicians, I've been kind of calling for action for a while. And there's pluses and minuses to that, but, you know, we saw it coming. I think that what we've done as a society and as physicians to sound the alarm has, I think, mitigated some of the damage. Again, time will tell, but it's been quite a unique perspective on seeing what that kind of slowly evolving story, again, it's still evolving as we speak, but I've seen it over time, where it's headed.
And when you say that policy trailed what you saw on the ground, mm-hmm. Give us some color commentary on that. Talk to us about that
sure.
a little bit.
Sure. So, you know, I think this goes all the way from a granular level to, you know, PPE and proper protection for the frontline staff. And that doesn't just mean physicians, it's nurses, it's housekeeping, it's anyone in the hospital setting, and how it's evolved from what you should be wearing to now it's a recommendation across states for people in public to be wearing a mask, right? I can tell you a few months ago, I remember, you know, people asking my opinion, like, what should I wear? I said, well, you know, wear the most protective equipment you can wear. And you know, we got some pushback and, you know, the hospitals were confronted not with just, you know, what you shouldn't wear, what you should, but also what's available, right? So I can tell you in the ER, what we would see was people coming in with obvious symptoms of COVID and you couldn't isolate them and they didn't have the typical symptoms of fever. By the letter of the law, I should say by the recommendations of CDC or be it hospital, based recommendations, they were lagging behind what we were seeing. So I guess the take-home message is, you know, listen to your front line. When it's a crisis and it's there's no playbook, but you're making the playbook as you go along, the best people to make that playbook off of are those who are confronting it. So, you know, that's just one aspect of this. And that goes all the way to, it's not business as usual. You know, people were worried about charting and proper documentation when that went out the window when you had a mass of patients to take care of.
In what's your sense of, and it might be impossible to predict, what does the next 6 to 12 months look like? Do you have a sense of what you expect? I don't know if you have kids in school or if you're past that age, sure. Younger than that age, I don't really know. But what's your sense of, are kids going to go back to school or not? What's your sense of what's likely to happen over the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I can tell you that, you know, there's personal my personal sense and in a broader sense. I can tell you on a broader sense, I think that can't go back to business as usual, right? I think that would be the biggest mistake. I think that this crisis has kind of uncovered a lot of the inefficiencies and a lot of the things that we thought we couldn't do and that we can do and do better. So I would say what do I expect? I think that there's, at least in healthcare, is a paradigm shift, right, in terms of what we did before the crisis and after the crisis. And that I could talk, you know, for hours on. From a personal level, I really think it's going to come down to how aggressive we are in identifying those people that are potentially ill or those who are not potentially contagious. And if I had to say the one word, it's testing. And I say testing with an asterisk. That means accurate, reliable testing, that you're going to be able to comfortably go out and feel safe. And that affects every aspect of life, right? I mean, I've always said, if there is a silver lining to this crisis, it's not really a silver lining, but one thing is that if this affected children the way it affects the vulnerable populations and the elderly, I think this crisis would have been massive. I think that most people would not, I can tell you on a personal level, I would have gone to work and never came back home. I would have stayed and kept my family isolated. So I think in a broad sense, it has to be something that where everyone feels relatively safe, that they're not endangering themselves, their family, or others. And that one way you can get there is through science. It's through accurate testing that's reliable. And until that happens, schools aren't going to be the same. Restaurants, all that.
Now, in terms of sort of the nation, you see mm-hmm. this sort of work in waves. And I think you and I realize that in a nation of 330 million people, it's imperfect, and certainly lots of things could be done better. It mm-hmm. does seem like that if you look at these things in pieces, the ventilators, the PPE, the testing, you would sort of say, and I'll ask you your opinion on this, on ventilators, with a hodgepodge of different efforts, we're about where the nation needs to be on ventilators, maybe not perfectly, but close. On PPE, we're still not in great shape. We're in good enough shape, but not really if you have to do elective and non-essential surgery and assume that every patient is a COVID patient, then you've got to use an abundance of PPE and you have to be so careful with it and very inefficient. So we've made great progress on PPE, and you see that all over, but not where we want to be yet, but much better. And testing, we're making progress from something that was just in an awful situation, maybe even just 2 to 4 weeks ago. I hear more and more of there being progress, not nearly the ramp up we need to have, but
right.
Give me your thoughts on those three thoughts: ventilators, PPE, and testing.
Well, I'll start with the ventilator question. And I say, thankfully, and again, whether it's a combination of things, whether it's our predictions were off, whether it's the virulency of this virus, we fortunately, at least in our area, didn't come to what I would consider worst case scenario for me personally, and in a broader sense of making a decision of rationing care. And so, I think that with a coordinated effort of adequate ventilators and distribution of ventilators and getting them where they need, because as you kind of alluded to, this goes in waves, right? You don't need all the ventilators everywhere at all the same time. So if we can figure that out, that's one way with addressing that. With the PPE, I put both of those, with the PPE and with the testing. I think this, in my opinion, has to be a nationally coordinated effort. Not to get political, but if we put all of our resources behind that effort in terms of keeping our healthcare workers safe, keeping everyone safe that needs to be. I mean, I liken it to a situation where, if we are coal miners going in the coal mine and there's 50 of us and you say, well, I have gear for 10 of you and I have a headlamp for 4, and you want everyone to be protected to the maximum level of being protected. And I think that as a country and as a nation, we can get behind this on a national level to make that a priority and make testing a priority. having it piecemeal isn't going to solve it. I think that we need a coordinated national response to make this a priority across states. And that's especially true in bordering states. You know, if New York does one thing and New Jersey does another, well, you know, I live in New York and I can tell you, I mean, from where I'm sitting, I can see New Jersey. So I'm going to just drive in New Jersey if I feel their you know, processes are better and vice versa. So I think a coordinated effort on PPE and testing has to happen. And if that happens, it can be done and we can mitigate this. And of course, there's a whole host of other things, you know, in terms of vaccines and treatment, but those two should be a priority on a national level, in my opinion.
Yes. And so don't you get the sense, as I look at mm-hmm. things, and it's anecdotal because I talk to hospital executives all over the country, that that progress on PPE is being made.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your sense?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I have, I think one other thing that this underscores, and again, it's a broader topic of reliable information. I could tell you, I'm part of a network of about 20 some thousand ER doctors that we discuss clinical issues, operational issues. And, you know, of course, it does involve complaints and gripes and what you have and what you don't. And it's hard to find out, you know, who has PPE and who doesn't. I can tell you anecdotally, I've heard horror stories, and I can't confirm that people don't have adequate equipment. But my sense is it's maybe limited to certain pockets. I can't say. Again, you hear from
No. What I would say is I listen to the national discussion. Mm-hmm. It's obviously the PPE is a problem. I talked to one hospital and they were explaining to me that if we don't have enough testing, we have to assume that every patient could have to do abundant PPE for, and thus our needs are endless. I mean, I talked to the CEO of a large health system in New York the other day, and he was explaining the amount of PPE they're going through in a given week. And it's an incredible amount and needed, and they need more of it. But it does seem like the PPE is a little bit less complex to ultimately get sorted out than the testing, which requires the reagents and the other pieces and stuff like that, and which is where our country's never been prepared for it before. And that's my sense, that testing, PPE, we might be a month from where we have to be. Testing, we're probably 2 to 3 months away from anywhere near close to adequate. That would just be my simple sense.
Thoughts
on that?
No, I would agree with that. I agree. And I can, again, I'm speaking from a perspective of someone in New York, New Jersey. And in that sense, that anyone that I'm coming in close proximity to, you know, and I practice what I call clinical social distancing. You know, if I have to take care of someone, then I don't need to listen to heart and lung sounds. I don't, right? But my sense in what's happening now is anyone that walks into my emergency department, I'm assuming they're COVID positive. Okay, and that's because it's an endemic in this area. So in that sense, if you are a healthcare worker on the front line, or you're in a hospital, you know, you want to take the maximum precaution you have, right? And especially if you're coming in any kind of patient contact, that's part of the reason why PPE is, you know, why they're as far as hospital administrators are concerned, is we're blowing through that rapidly because of the fact that we don't know and we're assuming that everyone has it. So it has to be, you're right, in conjunction with testing.
100%. Because what I understand, it's somewhat of a pendulum. PPE will start to normalize if we have enough testing. If we don't have enough testing, we're going to go through PPE at a rate that's unheard of but necessary. The next question I have for you, Dr. Trivedi, is antibody test. How, you know, people that are lay people, and many of us are lay people that work in healthcare in some way or another, but we're not physicians, and we're not the knowledge that our physician colleagues have or our hospital colleagues have. Explain to people just really quickly. We're all started getting a sense of it from the press and everything else. Antibody test versus test. Just talk to us for a moment about the difference between the two of those and where they each fit into the system.
Sure. So again, I'll put this with the asterisk of I'm just a simple ER doctor, but I will tell you that, you know, the test that we do for COVID that's
not the antibody test, is looking for the RNA of the virus, right? So you're looking at, do you have that virus in your system? And I'll give an anecdotal example. I had a gentleman a few weeks ago that I took care of, and he had the test. And this wasn't that long ago, but the test turnaround time was 3-4 days for this RNA test. And now that's a test to see if you have the virus in your system. I went back to examine him. The guy was not looking great. He had findings on his CAT scan, which are pretty consistent with COVID. I mean, he had a fever. He had all the signs and symptoms of COVID. And I said, look, you have COVID. I'm concerned. As I was talking, the test comes back and the test was negative. Now, I can tell you as a clinician and as a betting man, I said, that guy has COVID. Now, is it because that test was a false negative, or was it because when he had the test, he wasn't COVID, and now it's 3-4 days later and he has COVID? So that test is limited use to me. Now, an antibody test tests for if you've had the disease, you've had the virus, and your body has mounted a response. That's an antibody test. That means if you've had it and you've recovered from it and your body has produced antibodies, which some would argue is completely protective. Some would argue that it's not. You can get reinfected. But it's a lot more of a secure test to know that, okay, now I know that you had COVID and you have it. So that's the simple answer, and that's the test we need to allow people to get back in public and to say, hey, I've had it and I've recovered. So I don't know if that kind of makes sense and answers some of your questions, but that's the basics of it.
Well, I mean, 100%. And I know that sort of like we're still a little bit of a distance away from having tens of millions of antibody tests. And, you know, you hear this issue on testing throughout the country. In some places, still taking 4 to 7 days to get a result, in which case that's useful if you want to schedule an elective surgery with somebody because you want to know that day or the next day. And then in other places, you know, there's some health systems where it's literally 45 minutes and you have a result. So it's very different throughout the country and not quite uniform. And it seems like as the country started to catch up on ventilators, which was easier to solve than expected, although lots of discussion about it, PPE, which is getting solved or getting closer, and then testing seems to be still something that is really all over the board in terms of where it's got to be and where it's at today, is my impression. Yeah.
I know. I think that's an accurate assessment. I think so. And I think that's where I'm calling for some kind of national coordinated response. And when that happens, I think that people will more of a comfort level, right? And that, of course, impacts the healthcare system, no doubt. But that impacts, you know, every industry, right? I mean, that's
going to impact
everything, right? Healthcare, services, entertainment, whatever you want to bring into that mix. And until that happens, on a broader level, I think that people have a misconception, or maybe they're getting it now, that there's not a drop dead date. Like, okay, May 15th, everything's opening up. Well, you know, can you say that? And will people want to have a comfort level of going to a restaurant? And what will that look like? And if it's summer, is the air conditioning on, circulating? You need to know, are you at risk? Are you putting your family at risk? And are you putting someone else at risk? And that has to be a test that people feel comfortable and confident that they're not doing those things. And otherwise, I think it's just irresponsible to do that.
100%. And the concept being, it's almost like auditing a company or doing anything. You wouldn't do surgery without an X-ray or an image.
Correct.
I mean, you can't really get a sense of where we're at as a population without massive testing. And so here's a political question for you.
Sure.
There's a reality that ramping up testing in a country our size is a massive effort. So, so here's a question for you with President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Would he have been better off? He early on was saying things like, we have enough testing. Right. And whether you're right of center, left of center, whatever your politics are, if you're a thinking person, and you saw what was going on, you understood that was just really incorrect. At least at the times he was talking about it, and still today, we don't have enough testing. I mean, it would be my own assessment. So would he have been better off saying, we're a massive nation, it takes a serious amount of time to get to the amount of tests we need, we're working at it, we're pushing all these different buttons, we're talking to all these different people, yes, we're trying to push some of this off to the states, but we are working at it, rather than saying we have enough testing when we all knew that was false? I mean, because we would have kind of accepted as a population, look, we have 330 million people or 327, it's going to take a while. What's your sense of the politics of that and your thoughts on how it could have been handled differently?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, without getting into my politics, and I'm happy to do that, but...
you don't have to. You don't have to. Really, yeah, just no, I have no, a specific question. I'm not asking whether you're right or left or this
No. I'll tell you my opinion on this is it's very simple. I think I'll talk on two levels. I'll talk on a scientific evidence-based level, which is how we practice medicine. That's how we practice medicine in this country, right? It's based on evidence and it's based on facts. And facts shouldn't have any emotional component to it. The fact is that we were not prepared to test everyone. And if you have that as a fact that you can, then you can say it. If you don't, then you shouldn't say that. On a level, second level, I'll talk on a leadership level. The one thing I've seen during this crisis, and that goes from the top down, that goes from the president of the United States to the guy who owns a local, you know, pizza shop. This crisis has kind of underscored your leadership style. And it's one of two things. Either you become a deer in headlights and you are floored and you don't know what to do, or it becomes a call to action. And you say, look, it is what it is. Let me mobilize and do what I need to do to get through this and to protect the people that rely on me. I also think the one thing that I've seen, which has impressed me in leaders, whether that be you, a CEO of a hospital, president of the country, or a small business owner, is humility and admitting what you know and what you don't know and being honest. And that's respected. I don't think anyone would disrespect a CEO that comes out and says, hey, it's an unprecedented situation. I don't know what to do. I'm scared, but I'm going to work 24/7 to make the best of the situation to help protect you. That's what a leader does. I think there's been a failure of leadership on that end, on many levels, not just from the president, but from other organizations. So that those are the two things that if you base things on factual evidence, do we have enough testing and do we, and what is it based on? And let me admit to what I don't know and be wrong. The bluster and bravado, whether you're the president or whether you're the head of an organization, a CEO, is not needed right now. It will cost lives. So that's what I would say to that. You know, I agree with you 100% that it's irresponsible to say that there was that kind of testing because it gives false hope. It's a false narrative. There wasn't. And it's evident by the fact that that was said a long time ago and we're still where we are now. So again, it doesn't matter what your politics are. I think it's just it's a style of leadership, which I think most people would appreciate.
Let me ask you this question about humility. And one of the things is that so few of our, certainly the president and certainly several of the other political leaders of either party have a very hard time saying, we don't know and we're trying to figure it out.
Correct.
Why is there such an inability? Is that a male ego thing, the inability to say, I'm unsure, we're trying to figure it out? Or is it everybody's like that today? I mean, if you go on the social media, people are taking positions on, you know, the right or left, you know, almost as a litmus test. And why is that, that there's not this discussion of, you know, we're trying to figure out the right balance between staying open and solving the healthcare crises? Why is there a lack of vulnerability or ability to say, I'm not sure?
Well, I think that's a couple of things. One, I would think it's because of the polarizing nature of politics and our country, frankly, right? Any opening is seen as an opportunity to attack, right? So when you portray your vulnerability, whether you're left or right, the other side is going to use that as an opening and say, look at this. This is weak and the guy doesn't know what they're talking about, even though no one knows what they're talking about, right? So I think there's that aspect, right? So because there is such a clear divide, that vulnerability is exploited. Second, I would say, I think if someone who is, I don't know who you consider credible, but someone who would expose themselves and open themselves up to that, I think the majority of the country, you're still going to have your extreme right and your extreme left, will really appreciate that, you know, and I think that that's evidenced by, if you look at, you know, just opinion polling of Dr. Fauci or people who are trying to just portray it without any spin and the best they can, they're respected. Now, they're still the right
or the left, whoever say, you know, this guy is a shill for this side or that side. But I honestly think this is an opportunity to get back to admitting what we don't know, being open and exposed. Look, I mean, this crisis has affected everyone. It doesn't matter if you're in healthcare or not. And I think it has given people an idea and understanding, a broad understanding of, you know, what's most important. And I think that it's a mistake to just continue the status quo. You know, those days of bluster are really going to cost lives. You know, this is a healthcare issue. It's agnostic of your politics, right? So my sense would be, it would be refreshing if someone would just come out and say, hey, here's what it is. I don't know this. I'm working hard to figure that out. And again, that doesn't just go for the leadership of the country. That goes for leaders of the hospital systems, leaders of small businesses. And you know, frankly, admit where you may have failed and could have done better. You know, I'm not even going to get into the litigious aspect of it, but admitting those things, I think, would be refreshing and needed, to be honest.
When it builds great credibility, and you do see it, and it's not a lot, but you see it in some of the foreign leaders, where you see some of them saying, we're trying hard to figure this out. We haven't gotten there, but we're working at it. We're trying to figure it out. We don't know the answers. And when you see it, whichever leader it is a refreshing take, and and one respects it. In any event, Dr. Trevi, I've kept you for a long time. One other question. You've worked separately on some kind of telehealth company that you've developed or worked on or something you're doing in telehealth. Sure. Take a moment and tell the audience about that.
Sure. So partner in a company called StationMD, and we're a telehealth organization that provides medical services using our telehealth solution. We're primarily in what's called the IDD population. That's the intellectual and developmentally disabled population. You know, they're a vulnerable group of people that, when I say vulnerable in the sense of they have some immunocompromised situations and more prone to get COVID. Many of them live in a group home or congregate care setting, very similar to the skilled nursing facility. But so we've been doing this for several years, well before COVID. And really, I think COVID has just underscored the relevancy and the urgency of some kind of telehealth solution. So at StationMD, what we do is we basically bring the doctor upstream. We address their questions using this audiovisual technology. It's, if you know FaceTime or Skype, it's basically that. And the goal of that is to really keep people in place. In this age of COVID, it's more important than ever. But, you know, if someone has a cold or a cough or needs a medication refill, anything that can keep people out of the healthcare system, I think it is important. With this population, it's even more important because they do rely on support staff. So you're not just putting them at risk, you're putting someone else at risk who has to take them. Sometimes it requires specialized transport. And I could tell you the New York area, New Jersey area, we've had some really unfortunate instances where this virus has kind of torn through some of these group homes with several deaths and support staff being injured. But, you know, I'm really proud of the work we're doing. I tell you, a measure of society during this kind of crisis is how they treat their most vulnerable. And that means this population, the elderly, prisoners. So again, very proud of the work our doctors are doing in this setting. But I do think that telehealth is as everyone's probably aware of, time has come, and unfortunately it took a crisis to show that. But I do think that it's a technological solution that will address a lot of the issues that we're going to see for a few months and maybe for a few years down the road.
Good. Thank you very much, Dr. Trevi. Congratulations on what you've done, and just a pleasure visiting with you today and learning what you're seeing and your perspectives. I appreciate your thoughts so much, and thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Scott. Take care.